welcome to episode 79 of the Planning Period Podcast, your Ed Break Room. I'm your host, Brad Shuffler. This week on the show, I am joined by Dr. Michael Armbruster, Associate Superintendent of Career and Technical Education in a large district in Central Florida, my district. Mike and I actually have a lot of mutual friends. I taught at the school he used to be a principal at, and he is always a great storyteller every time I talk to him. So I knew he'd make a great guest on the show. And I also thought his experience in career and technical education would give him a great perspective to talk about the problems in education. Dr. Armbruster and I talk about the shift in stigma around technical education, the benefits of those programs, the problems with our model of education right now, how budget plays into school decisions, the importance of facilitating in the classroom, how technology has changed the paradigm of teaching for a generation, and how great teachers last in your memory forever. So, sit back and enjoy episode 79 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Dr. Michael Armbruster. Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Brad Shuffler, and I'm excited today because I say this a lot, I feel like, but today it's one of those episodes that's been a long time in the making, took some time to get scheduled, and truthfully, this one's more on me. It took me a long time to actually reach out to my guest today, even though we've talked a few times. But one of the things I've said before on this podcast is that my district, one of the best things we do is our technical education program. I think it's the shining jewel of our district, in my opinion. And I'm really excited today to be joined by the man who runs our technical education program, Dr. Michael Armbruster. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Good, good. For my audience who, you know, my introduction's probably not enough, could you tell me a little bit about who you are and kind of your background in education?
Sure. It's a long story. So I was born back in 19. No, I won't go that far back. But actually, I went to college to be a teacher and flunked out my senior year, ended up being a general manager of a local country club where we live, and ended up going back to school, found out I could be a non-degree teacher to teach career and technical education. Welders, cabinet makers, they don't really generally, as a rule, go to college. So I came in as a person teaching turf grass operations. It was a golf course maintenance and management program. Went on to get finished my degree in vocational technical education, went on to get my master's, and ended up becoming an assistant principal at a local high school that I happened to graduate from, then became principal of that high school, got to open another local high school, and then got to go out and rebuild yet another high school. But I always had a passion for career and technical education, and so the position I'm in now opened up, and I applied, and fortunately got the position. So I've had a great 32 years so far, and looking forward to a few more to really get us to the next level in CTE.
Yeah. You know, I've known your background. Obviously we I worked at the school. You were a principal for a while, or assistant principal, I should say. And, you know, so I know of you, of course, and I know your wife as well, who was at that school with me. And, you know, and like I said at the beginning, I've definitely believed that, you know, in education, it's really easy to see the negatives, especially when you're a district as large as ours and feel sometimes like the ship moves so very slowly. But, you know, you genuinely lead probably the best thing I think we do in our area. And I think that we're really beginning to see where technical education is losing some of the negative stigma of that's just for people that can't go to college. And I attribute that success very much to you and your work at the district level.
Well, I appreciate that. I'd love to take credit for it, but really, it's a great team of people. And I think we're just in the right time and the right place in our nation to realize that we've been kind of gearing in one direction for a long time, probably since the 50s, probably since the GI Bill. The American dream changed to having your kids go to college. And it's a great thing, and there's nothing wrong with that. I spent probably 30 years in college in a variety of ways, probably a lot longer than I should have. But the truth of the matter is only 30% of American adults today, based on the last census, which was done in, I want to say, 2016, only 30% of American adults over 25 years old have college degrees. But if you were to ask most people on the street, they would think that number's a lot higher. And the truth of the matter is a lot of the 70% who don't are living great lives, doing the things they want to do and enjoying lives that they set out to do. So I think we created this perception and this illusion that college was the only way to success. And while it is a way to success and a great way to success, man, it's really not the only way. And so we've been working hard and getting a lot of attention on getting this idea of there's multiple ways to get there. And one way doesn't preclude the other. Students who go through our programs oftentimes end up in college. And likewise, a lot of our students are people who have college degrees who come back and retrain in something else because they haven't been able to find the occupation of their dreams that they went to college to get. So it really is a redefining of what the American dream is. And it's more focused on career than focused on going to college. We've done a disservice to students when we push college, 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 when in reality, college is just a means to an end, but we've made it the end in a lot of people's minds. And I think we're getting better at not doing that anymore. So it's just a matter really of timing as much as anything else.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, I began to see when I was still at the high school level, and I began to see where, you know, people were taking, you know, the CTE courses side by side with AP and the honors level and the advanced level courses and the higher ed courses. And they were taking CTE side by side with dual enrollment and getting college credit while in CTE. And I think that, you know, you have done such a great job speaking out and your team have done such a great job of promoting that it is an option, and it doesn't even necessarily preclude the other. You could go through the CTE program and get a certification in one of these industry fields and then still go to college and have that as a backup. And I think that that's sort of where that shift is starting to happen in a really powerful way.
And I think it is. And I think it's a great thing. You know, one of my favorite stories, I had a parent who was upset with me because of a guidance counselor at her son's school. And what she was upset about was she wanted her son to go to college and be a lawyer. Her son didn't want to go to college to be a lawyer, but he wanted to go to college, but he had a different mindset. And so what he told his mom was he wanted to take a dual enrollment program through our school, a vocational school, and he wanted to take a program called Pharmacy Tech. And his mom said, well, let's talk to your counselor. And she went in and talked to the counselor, and the counselor said, oh, no, your son's smart. He needs to be taking AP classes. And so she said, son, you need to take AP classes. So he talked her into going to an orientation at one of our sites. And she actually was impressed by the orientation. And so she said, you know, I'm willing to give you a try. She talked to the teacher. And so the son ended up his junior year still taking an AP class or two, but he took the Pharmacy Tech program, graduated his senior year, got accepted into FAMU, which is where he wanted to go, and got early admissions into the pharmaceutical program there, and now has a 2-year head start, and he's working in the profession as a pharmacy tech that he's going to college to do. And so most certainly taking a CTE program didn't hurt him. It really built him up. But the thing that she was upset about was the counselor didn't see the value in the CTE, only saw one route to her child's success, and that was through AP classes. And again, AP classes are wonderful, but they're not isolated from CT. So here was a student who did both and accomplished his dreams and is now, you know, up at school way ahead of his classmates, and he's a pharmacy tech gonna become a pharmacist. And so that, you know, that's the power of CT. It's not for those students. It's really for all students. And it's actually beneficial for a lot of students to take that while they're in high school.
Well, and I think the other thing that's really great about it is there's a huge pressure for acceleration right now. You know, we're pushing acceleration left and right. And what I like about the CTE program as an acceleration path is that it's real world experience. It's not, I worry a lot about the downsides of AP acceleration and IB programs and dual enrollment even, because they're getting this acceleration in their general ed courses. And then they're a freshman in college with all that done. And now they have to make that major decision, and changing majors in your third year of college is a lot bigger deal than in your first. And we've kind of made the freshman year the first year of college versus CTE, where they're getting experience in the thing they think they're passionate about to really determine if it really is what they're passionate about. And they're getting to do it while they're in high school and still meeting those acceleration expectations.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I think that, you know, we're in a good time for CT, and certainly the acceleration points counted towards a school grade has opened up principals and counselors' minds to the benefits of CTE. Maybe not necessarily for the noble reasons initially, but once they've opened up their minds, they've actually seen the value of it. And absolutely, students who go through our CT programs do get a chance to try things, to do things. But more importantly, they come out with job skills. And again, there's nothing wrong with AP. I think AP classes are wonderful. My daughter took 14 of them while she was in high school, and she's an engineer now, went to Georgia Tech, the top industrial engineering school in the nation. And absolutely, the AP classes helped her. But on the other side of it, AP Calc was the only course that Georgia Tech accepted when she got there. And, you know, it would not have hurt her to have taken an electrical program to learn about electricity while she was there. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so it would have given her a real understanding of the hands-on side of things. And so it is kind of a conundrum because you're trying to find the best path for a child. But again, I think that there's a balance. I have a, it's a silly analogy I use, but I think it still holds water that, you know, historically in the last 50 years, college has been considered or university has been considered the steak, and CTE has been considered hamburger, not just hamburger, but like a nasty hamburger. and really, you know, it's been a very low level. Now what I like to say and what I see more and more of is that absolutely university is steak, but CTE is lobster. And they're both equally valuable depending on where you're trying to go. And then really to get the best of both worlds, if you get surf and turf or steak and lobster, however you want to phrase it, I think those kids come out well-balanced, well-prepared, better decision makers, and actually end up more successful when they get to college and university, if that's their choice, and more successful if they go straight to work or they go to a technical college or they go to a state college. I just think that the balance in that really creates a better student. And the reason I was so passionate about CT is I saw so many kids who we lost along the way in high schools. And I was at three different high schools as a principal. One was majority white, one was majority black, one was majority Hispanic. And I saw the same things in all high schools. Parents want their kids to be successful. Parents want schools to love their kids, and they want their kids to come out with some kind of an idea of where they're heading. And CTE is a powerful way for a kid to find their, you know, their idea of where they want to go. And all that other stuff is important too. And if we can match them up and get steak and lobster as the norm for all students, I'm telling you, we would see a whole lot of positive things happening on test scores, on acceleration, on all that stuff, but more importantly, on the student themselves.
Yeah, it's hard to argue with that. I just love it. I love it so much. It makes me happy. And you know, it can be, like I said before, it can be really easy to be down on some of the decisions that are made at a district level, but in any district really. And I always look at CTE as the thing that we're doing most right. And I always am excited about that. But I think that's a pretty solid intro. And I want to get to my major questions that I ask all my guests. And my first question for all my guests is, what is the biggest problem facing education today?
That's a great question. I'm sure you get answers like parents, the state government, all of those kinds of things. And mm-hmm. And those all sound good, and they're good sound bites and everything. But really, I think what, for me, the biggest problem of what's facing education today is we're still educating students in the model we developed 50 to 75 years ago, and we can't let go of what we've always done. I learned from a great man, actually somebody who I respected tremendously. He happened to pass away a couple of years ago, named Rick DeFore. And he used to tell this story about he had bad eyesight, and he went to his doctor, and his doctor said, hey, we can do this surgery. It's called a radiokeratotomy, I think is what he called it. And he said, we bring you in and we slice your eye open with a razor, and then we go in and we shave, and then we cover your eye for about 6 months. And then eventually when we take it off, you'll be able to see a little clearer. And over time, your eye will clear up and you'll have almost perfect vision. And so he went through and he did it. And he said, a few years later, my sister went and had the same issue. And they said, listen, we've got this new procedure called LASIK. We'll bring you in, we'll do a little sliver, we'll go bzz, 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 for about 2 minutes. And when you walk out, you'll have perfect vision. He said, now, how many radiokeratotomy businesses do you still think exist versus LASIK, right? But in education, we're still doing radiokeratotomies in a world where LASIK exists. And I think for me, that's our biggest problem. We have to have students within certain amount of times. We have 55 minutes or 50 minutes. We have to get them busted this time of day. School has to start here and end here. And the reality is, it doesn't work anymore. We should have school, honestly, 18 hours a day. We should have availability. We should have online classes. We should have large classes, small classes. Schools should look totally different than what they look like now. And so that's what I think our biggest problem is. Parent apathy existed 50 years ago. I watch shows and movies, you know, I watched a couple weeks back Blackboard Jungle with Glenn Ford. I watched To Sir with Love with Sidney Poitier. Those were made in the 50s and the 60s, and the same issues were talked about, apathy and all of that. But the truth of the matter is, for me, if we could really transform our schools, we would see tremendous change in students and where we're getting in success of students. I just think that that's where we really are missing the boat. We've done some cool things here and there, and we've tried to do things, but we keep trying to do them in the same box that we've always had. We still build a factory model school, which was, you know, when schools were designed that way, they were designed to get people ready to work in factories. You know, that's why we have bells. Bells were to teach them you work between the break bell and the work bell. They weren't put in to control students. They were put in to condition students to how work in their factories would go. So I think that for me, that's the biggest thing. I just would love to see a total put it away. And let's start with what we know today. You know, LASIK surgery isn't anything like radiokeratotomy. A light bulb isn't an improved candle. A light bulb is a totally different way of producing light. And I think we need to let go of the candle and quit trying to make the candle work and actually invent the light bulb the way Edison and his team did. So that may be a little different answer than what you used to, but I hope it makes sense. I think that our structure is stopping us from the amazing things we could be doing. And every now and then we get peaks of it where you see classrooms that are run differently than the normal classroom. We still talk about class size amendment. You got 25 students in a classroom. Who determines that 25 is a magic number? I've seen teachers with 100 kids in certain programs just knock the socks off it. I've seen other teachers with 10 students who couldn't get anything done because they just ran it in the old way. But we like those boxes, you know, 25 students, 180 days, you know. The thing I love about CTE is that we're competency-based. So a student who comes in and is really working fast in a program, the program may be a year in length. They can get done in 10 months. If they're a little slower, it may take them 12 months or 13 months or 14 months. But they work and we push them at their pace, and they're all over the place. When you walk into an air conditioning program, you've got students who are at day one, students who are at day 50, and students who two students who may be at their day 50, but one's at day 40 and one's at day 60. And that individualized way of approaching education really works for us. And it would work, I believe, in the way we do schools. And some people do it. Some teachers are natural at doing it. They make it happen. It happens in classrooms all over our district. It just doesn't happen as the way we do school in our country right now.
Well, and like you said, even when it's happening in schools in our district, even when it's happening in bits and pieces, it's still confined to the box of a solid structure that really does not have any sort of flexibility for us to play with.
And absolutely. I'm sorry, I cut you off.
Go ahead.
But I was going to say, that's why Florida Virtual School, as one example across the country, is huge. Because people want and demand flexibility. When do I watch TV? You know when I watch TV now? When I want to. You know when I watch what I want to see? When I want to. You know when I get groceries? When I want to. I go online. If I want to get something, I go to Amazon and there it is. And whether we think that schools can't be that way, they can absolutely be that way. Colleges have been trying to do it. Again, they're stuck within structures as well. But I just think the world has shifted and moved. I mean, think about what you do today and how you do it. I mean, we're sitting here having a podcast session, and I'm sitting in my home, and you're probably sitting in your home, and we're doing it now, and who knows when it'll go out there. But that's, and who knows when people will listen to it. You're not going to put it out, you know, Sunday night at 7 p.m., watch the podcast. It's going to be there and available for people to listen to when they want. And yet we still say school has to start at 7:20 and end at 2:20, and it's 50-minute periods, 180 days a year. It's crazy, really. It is. But it is what it is right now.
What do we do to fix it, right? Like, what is the action that a teacher or an administrator or a parent can take right now to sort of say, yes, this needs to change, help us fix it? Like, what do we got to do?
Well, one of the areas, honestly, and this is going to come back to a traditional answer, is at least in our state, funding is ridiculous. The man I spoke about earlier, Rick DeFore, I went and visited his school that he had been principal out for a long time before he became superintendent, before he became Rick DeFore, who, if you're not familiar with him, is like the guru of professional learning communities. But anyway, I go to his school and I'm looking around at how they operate, and it's entirely different. We, at that time when I went, I think we were getting somewhere in the neighborhood of 5,000 or 6,000 per student. They were getting 15,000 to 16,000 per student. And they had tutoring centers. They had students actually had periods off during their day where they could go do this or go do that. There was so much freedom and flexibility, but it took funds to do that because they had to have people that were there to supervise, not teachers. Teachers weren't doing duty. They had people who were actually there paid to supervise. You know, and they were able to do things differently than we are with that kind of financing. Money is a huge, huge issue for us, especially in the state of Florida. Our funding model is not that good. So it's not that money buys everything, but money allows you to be more creative. You know, money, when you don't have it, forces you to build boxes, to be able to manage what you have within that limitation. When I was principal at one of the schools I was principal at, we built a unique system. We built a schedule that was totally different than the norm. It was an alternating block. You went to periods 1, 2, 3 on Monday, 4, 5, 6 on Tuesday. So you had 90-minute periods. But in the middle of the day, we had a regular period that we called research. And in that period, depending on how you were as a student, you either had study hall, you had one-on-one tutoring, one-on-one mentoring. You may be in there for an hour. If you were on target and had passed your state tests, you had an hour lunch. If you weren't, you had a 30-minute lunch and an hour of support systems, right? So it allowed us to have some flexibility, and we were amazing. We were number 12 in socioeconomic levels, and we were one of the first 5 schools to break the 90% graduation rate, and the top 4 were the top 4 socioeconomic schools in the district, and we came from number 12 to be the 5th one to break 90%, and it was because we did school differently. Teachers collaborated every day. It was built into the schedule because we stole minutes out of passing times, which allowed us to add minutes to the end of the day, which allowed teachers to collaborate every day. It was a different way of doing business. To give you an example, we had all our 9th grade teachers met on Monday afternoon, all our 10th grade on Tuesday, 11th grade on Wednesday, and 12th grade on Friday. But then I also had teachers teach 3 preps, which sounds horrendous, but here's what happened. When they met to collaborate, whenever English 1 teachers were meeting, there were also 2s, 3s, and 4s in that same meeting. And so they were able to vertically align curriculum while they were horizontally aligning it. And they were really doing what a PLC was designed to do. They were deciding what, when, and how to assess what was being taught. And so they worked together as professionals. And it was an amazing model that worked really well. But it was difficult because it took some funding sacrifices to make it happen. We had to give up some things in order for that to happen, or we had to do some things differently to make that happen. And it shouldn't have come down to funding being the issue, because it really reconnected kids. It connected them to the point that 90% of them were graduating at a time when in the district, the average was about 75. So, you know, doing it differently paid huge dividends. But it comes back down to, you've got to be able to fund it. And, you know, if you were told as a teacher, you got to teach 3 preps, you would go nuts. But when you find out that you're going to be able to collaborate every day during your school day, not after school, during your 7.5 hours, plus you're still going to have your planning period every other day because it's a block schedule, right? Yeah. So you got your planning period every other day, plus you got 45 minutes of paid collaboration time every day. If you happen to be, you know, if you were Monday and you had English 1, 2, and 3, you'd be Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Thursday, you didn't have to collaborate. Friday, you didn't have to collaborate. You know, it made a tremendous difference. And now you had support. You had teachers working together, developing common assessments, the teachers themselves developing those common assessments, developing common orders of instruction themselves, not me dictating to them, this is what it needs to be. And the power of that collaboration was phenomenal. I remember one time, and if I'm rambling, you can sure cut me off, but I remember one time where I had the English teachers come to me, the whole department, and said, listen, our writing scores were not good. And so I said to him, we got to solve this. We meaning y'all, because y'all are the professionals. I don't know English the way you know it. I flunked when I was trying to be an English teacher. But here's the deal. You guys need to do this. And so they did, and they met, and they looked at three different programs themselves. They came to me and said, look, this is the program we think can make this happen. And I said, well, what do you need from me? They said, well, we don't like to train the trainer model. We all want to go to the training. It's a two-day training. And I said, so you want me to get 18 subs for you and pay for the training? And they said, yeah. And I said, okay. So I got 18 subs, because every kid only has one English teacher, so every kid only had one sub. And so I sent them. You know, they came back from that training on the Friday afternoon. On Monday, they implemented it. School-wide, what they were doing. And you know, that year we had a 17-point increase in our writing scores. We were number one in the district, tied with another school in our district. And that was all driven by the teachers using their expertise, working together in collaboration to solve that problem. That's huge. That's huge. But again, like it costs a few more dollars.
Right, the money there, right? Like, I mean, the cost to have 18 subs and two TDYs per teacher, that's a big investment. That's a big amount of money. And a lot of our schools just simply don't have it.
No, they don't in the current structure. They don't. To be honest with you, I probably didn't have it, but other things got sacrificed because the student learning was number one. Maybe we didn't have some of the stuff other schools had, but that was okay because the trade-off was that. I had teachers one year because it's when the budget cliff hit, and I went to them and I said, look, if we don't do something, then I'm going to have to change the model. We can't support the model as is. I said, one way we could support it, and I hate to ask you this, is if you taught seven periods, for every six of you who did that, I would save $30,000. And then that would afford me to do this and this. I had 81, it might have been 83, 81% of the teachers were so committed to what we were doing, they taught seven periods that next year to get us over the cliff. And because they believed in what we were doing. But that's, you know what it's like to teach seven periods a day, especially if you've got three preps. But they did that because they believed in what we were doing for kids, and they saw the results of what they were doing for kids. And they didn't have to do it. I mean, it was purely optional. I said, if we don't, you know, if we can't find a way, then we're going to have to cut this, 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 and this. And they came through and did that. And that was a testament to them. They were a very special staff to do that.
Well, and I think the other thing I notice in your story is the level of transparency that you had as a leader. I don't know how often principals are that transparent about budget, and we just simply don't have the money to do this, or here's what we would need. I don't know how often that transparency exists at a school level.
Yeah, and I don't. I know that I always was, because they needed to know to make good decisions. I'll give you another crazy example. We were getting 20 new teachers, and we didn't have portables. They couldn't put portables in at that time. And so I went to the staff and I said, look, there's a couple ways we can do this. I can float all of these teachers every period, every day. I said, but because we're on an alternating block, here's another option that's possible, but I'm going to give it to the committee, and the committee will make the decision, and then we will abide by the decision. I said, if all of you float one period, just one period, then what would happen is one period every other day you would float, no teacher would have to float more than one period every other day. So we can make these 20 float six periods every day, which will kill them, which will burn them out, which will send them away. Or we can all take a period every other day. You'll have your room for five periods. You'll float one period, and nobody has to float more than that. And next year, when we're able to put the portables in, nobody will float. And you know what? They got together, the committee, they came back, and they agreed. And because they knew and understood what it meant. Now, they weren't all happy, I got to be honest with you, but not one teacher grieved it. Not one teacher said no. Not one teacher left because of it. We gave them all rolling carts the first day of school. And at the end of the year, the teachers came out and said, you know what? It would be unconscionable to make somebody do that every period, every day. We only had to do it one period every other day. And the other thing they said was, it got us out with the students in a way we've never been out before. And they said, we actually found out we like our kids. And I mean that in a funny way, like not just their kids, but our kids. You know, it's not, I don't just like my students, I like our students. You know, kids would open doors for them, kids would help them up the stairs, whatever. But that was a huge commitment. That's totally different than the norm. But going back to your statement, I think when you give teachers all the information and you share all the facts, they'll make the right decisions, or they'll make the best decisions they can with the information they have. And, you know, teachers have rarely, as a group, ever let me down in my belief in them, if that makes sense, you know? I just think that really most teachers, are there bad teachers? Absolutely. There's bad everybody. But most teachers are in it for the right reason, because most teachers honestly could do something else. You know, people don't think that, or they make fun, or they make comments. You know, we just had a teacher at one of the schools that I was principal at win a Grammy. Now tell me he can't do something else, right? He had Alicia Keys introduce him during the Grammys on TV. You're telling me that guy can't do something else but teach? No, we got a lot of teachers that are Grammy level winners that that deserve better respect than what we give. But anyway, that's a whole nother story. I kind of got sidetracked there.
That's okay. Totally get it. Okay. And I'm always for talking about Dr. Jeffrey Redding, because that man is a beast.
He's an amazing human being. And you know what? I'm going to take, since you mentioned the name, I'm going to take credit, because I'm the man who hired him when I was an assistant principal. So part of that Grammy goes to me. No, none of that Grammy goes to me. He earned every bit of that. He has done more. I got to tell you a funny story about that, that I put a post, I went out, they welcomed him back from the Grammys at his high school. So I went out and I filmed about a 10 second clip of him walking out to the red carpet in the courtyard at the high school. And I think last time I looked, it was 71,000 views. Now, the highest I think I've ever gotten before that was 300. So that tells you how much of an impact he's had over the years with the number of students, because students were just sharing it and share. It was over 900 shares, I think. And I don't know how the analytics work. All I know is I've never had anything go to 70,000. That's the kind of impact a teacher can make in this world. And that's the kind of impact he's made.
Yeah. I like, I like how you said that there's a lot of teachers that are Grammy level teachers. I think that's a really cool way to put it, because we do have just some phenomenal teachers all around us. And I think sometimes it's really easy to lose sight of that.
Oh, absolutely. I've got my daughter, as I mentioned, took AP class. She had a handful of teachers that were Grammy level, but one that comes to mind is a quiet math teacher at one of my former schools that named Bob Restivo, who teaches calculus. But he doesn't just teach calculus. I mean, this guy, when he gives them homework, he grades all of their homework. He gives them input. He goes through problems. He has, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of a 94-96% success rate on AP calculus. If he's not the highest, he's always number two or number one, but generally he's number one in the district. And he takes whatever kids are given to him, and he works and tutors and comes in early and stays late. And these kids know calculus when they leave. It's not that they're, you know, she got a five on it. It was the only five out of the 14 AP classes she had. The only five she got was in AP calculus. And it's because he was a Grammy level teacher.
He actually came up on last week's episode, believe it or not. Cause
I do believe it. He's that good.
He's come up a few times. So, he is one of those guys that is another one that's just a phenomenal
teacher. I didn't hire him, but I did try to hire him. I tried to talk him into going to my new school, but he stayed. But I'm so glad he stayed, because had he gone with me, he wouldn't have had my daughter, because she went to my old school, not my new school. So it worked out that he said no. But he said no very kindly, and he said, no, this is my home. I'm going to stay here. I said, I understand.
Very cool. Oh, man, I love it. You know, I'm with you. I think the model is a huge problem. I've actually been on other people's podcasts. We did a show about the models of education. And I think what I said is we should just burn it all to the ground and see what rises out of the ashes. So I'm 100% with you on that one. And I agree completely that the budget plays a huge role in causing some of those models to be inflexible and be the way they are. So I think you're onto the right track there with something we could definitely be working on in education, for sure. But I want to move into my second question, and you know,
gosh, that was only the first one.
Well, that's only one. I know it flies by, right?
Yeah, it does. I get rolling, and you get me rolling. See, you're guilty. I'm the one. I'm just doing what you're leading me to
that's,
do.
That's what my show's for. I make sure I don't talk much. I let you talk. So, so all right. So my second question for you is, what is something you're doing that you wish all teachers would do?
Oh, gosh. Something that I'm doing?
Yeah.
I think what I'm doing, and what I think I do well, is facilitate. I think that I would love to see more teachers empower students the way that I see the master teachers do. I would love to see more teachers stop being in the front teaching people, or what we used to call teaching people, and really serving as a facilitator, letting the skills and talents and gifts of the students come out through their own self-discovery, through their own lessons learned as they're doing it. So I think that I see the role of the teacher, when I see really good teachers, flipped or flopped, where the students do the work and the students do the learning. You know, I had teachers growing up, and I know kids today still have teachers growing up who still stand at the front of the room and tell people what they need to know. And gosh, that just, it drives me crazy when I see that. The teachers who I've seen that are successful talk less. Sort of like in the play Hamilton, they talk less, smile more, but the difference is they engage the students in ways that get the students to learn. They're not afraid of a noisy classroom. They're not afraid of students talking and sharing and learning and making mistakes and having problems. They're not afraid to empower the kids to take responsibility for their own learning. Like the writing issue I shared with the English teachers at that school, I told them, we got a problem here. We got to fix it. I'm giving you the freedom to choose how you think we should fix it, and I will support you in whatever decision you make, and have, if I can, I'll give you what you need, but you guys got to figure this out because you're the experts. Now, the students certainly aren't the experts, but gosh, can't you give them that freedom to learn and give them that freedom to educate themselves and do some of that with you being a support and a resource and, again, a facilitator? Again, one of the things I love about CTE is the teachers can't teach in the old traditional ways. Now, certainly they'll pull students together for maybe a safety piece or for this piece or that piece. But when you go into a welding shop, those students are all at different levels. And people say, well, yeah, well, you can do that in welding. You can't do that in English. Yes, you can. I've seen master teachers do it in English. I've seen kids in English classes at all levels. I've seen teachers who say, you know what? We're going to read Frankenstein, but here's different levels of the book. The kids don't know that, but the teacher knows that, and the kids can read at the level they need to be at, not all read the same book where half of them are way beyond that level and the other half can't get to that level, and there's a few in the middle that it fits for. You got to have the freedom and the flexibility. We're not teaching Frankenstein. Maybe we're teaching Gothic horror, and everybody's reading a different book. Imagine that. I just think that if teachers could step back sometimes, especially those that are locked into that old method of teaching, and realize, let the kids go, man. These kids are learning at rates. This generation, and really probably to 15 years ago, you think about it. When I was a young man, I'm 57 now. When I was a young man, everything I learned from adults. As an adult, most of what I've learned in technology, I've learned from children, right? Children in this generation have been teaching adults from the time they were young because they're the ones who get it. No other generation did that. No other kids came along prior to the technology age and taught the adults in their world how to do things, right? This generation has grown up teaching the adults in their families, in their houses, in their, you know, their grandparents how to do stuff, from using phones to programming VCRs. And so then we bring them to school and we go back to the old model is, I got to teach them. No, you don't. They learn, they apply, and then they teach themselves. So just make that happen more. So that's a lot. Facilitation, empowering, and creating an atmosphere and an attitude where they can learn. That's not to say there isn't a place for teaching in the old way, but it's really very few and far between, in my opinion. That's just my opinion. You know, a lot of people disagree with that, but I'm telling you, I've walked a lot of classrooms. I've hired a lot of teachers. I've released a lot of teachers over the years. And I can tell you, the classrooms I walk in where learning is really happening is most of the time a facilitated, empowered classroom. And the students are doing the work and doing the talking.
Man, I'm a digital coach. I do technology in classrooms, and I think about the impact of technology on education and on children every day. And what you just said, I've never thought of that way, about how the advent of technology meant that these children taught adults in a way no other generation has ever done. And that's such a wow. That is so cool. that is so neat. And you're right. I never thought about the implications of that on the classroom. You know, a lot of teachers struggle with respect and, oh, when I was their age, I would have never talked to a teacher that way, or I would have had respect for a teacher. And I wonder if some of that comes from this, that they weren't even looking at their parents as the ultimate source of knowledge. They figured things out themselves and then taught their parents how to do things in a way other generations definitely haven't. That is, man, that's cool. That is real neat. I like that.
Well, good. Wow. I'm glad that makes it worth it today. Yeah. I feel good. Yeah. No, I feel good. I mean that in the best possible way. I'm glad. But I think there's a lot to that. And I think what you just said, there's a lot to that. You know, in my time, when a teacher said that Christopher Columbus discovered America, you took that as gospel. We know now that that's probably not the truth. There were people already here before him. So obviously he didn't. And, you know, Leif Erikson, whatever, it doesn't matter. But today, when you say that, kids tell you, no, that's not correct. And so sometimes teachers perceive that as disrespect, but the truth is, it's not correct, right? In the old days, we never questioned it, and we lived our whole life. You know, I answer questions on Jeopardy now wrong because teachers taught me wrong and I believed it, you know? And I'm like, well, that's not what my teacher told me in fourth grade. So the kids today don't need the teacher to teach them facts because they're going to fact check the teacher anyway. They need the teacher to teach them how to think and how to grow and how to figure it out on their own and give them opportunities to push them forward. Because what teacher in most areas can possibly keep up with what's happening every day here? They've got to be constant learners themselves, right? Because it changes every day. Look at what you do, technology. Look at what you do today versus what you did 2 years ago, right? Just the shifts in 2 years. And so it's got to be that kind of a mindset of, hey, learning is for all of us and we're all here and we can all learn together. It's not, I never was big on teaching. I was always big on learning. In fact, our mission statement was the fundamental purpose of our school is learning, not the fundamental purpose of our school is teaching. Teaching means nothing if nobody learns anything. And so just that paradigm shift from teaching to learning is huge, because what that does is it changes the conversation from, well, I taught them, it's not my fault if they didn't get it, to they didn't learn it. What can I do differently to ensure that they do? You see that little nuance?
Yep.
So I really wish they weren't called teachers so much anymore as coaches or guides or whatever, not because I don't like the word teacher, but because I think it focuses on the teaching instead of the learning. It's like fishing is a stupid word, right? Because really most of the time it's just watching or sitting. Every now and then you catch a fish, but the vast majority of the time when you go fishing, you're not really catching fish. And so I think the focus should be on learning, not on teaching. And the best teachers do that. The best teachers focus on the learning, and they take away all the excuses from the kids, from the disrespect and all of that. And they just say, look, Johnny didn't get it. What am I going to do to get Johnny to get it? Okay, we're going to try this. Okay, we're going to try that. Let's do this. And they don't rest until Johnny learns what they set out for Johnny to learn. But when you focus on teaching, then all you're focused on is your actions as a teacher. Well, I spoke. I didn't ask non-responsive or I didn't ask questions in unison. Those are all teacher actions, but they have nothing at all to do with student learning, right? So you can be, quote, a good teacher by a certain rubric and not have one kid learn anything that you set out for them to learn.
Yeah, so, and I think you're right. That facilitating component, I still see it, you know, and I feel like we've been saying that for a long time at this point, and yet I will still, you know, do a coaching observation, or I'll hear about a formal being scheduled and they'll be like, all right, well, I got to teach today. And they do their formal observation and it's them lecturing. It's like, dude, like, that's not what we want to see. That's the opposite of what we want to see. But I think they still fall into that mindset of, well, that's teaching. Teaching is the talking. That's the telling the information to the students. And it's like, no, that's not. Students learning is what matters. Like you said, that paradigm shift of, I want to see students learning when I walk into a classroom. I don't care if you're talking to them or not. If you've established a lesson and set something up phenomenal ahead of time that runs itself, and you just have to monitor and make sure kids are on task and facilitate, like you said, then beautiful. That's amazing education. That's amazing teaching. That's what I want to see. Not you standing up front and being able to make the best joke that keeps your kids engaged.
Absolutely. And when our mission was the fundamental purpose is learning, that was for everybody in the building. It wasn't for the students. It was for everybody in the building. And we reiterated that over and over again. Look, so that's why we did staff development. That's why we did professional development. That's why we did all those things, was that it wasn't just learning for the kids. It was learning for everybody. And when you create an environment focused on learning, great teaching happens. You know what I mean? It does. And again, it's the definition of teaching that you described that needs to go by the wayside, that it's the standing up and performing. It's not. Great teachers don't lecture, their students learn.
I like it. So great teachers don't lecture, their students learn. I love it. That is perfect. I'm gonna close out question two with that quote, and we're gonna go into my final question. I only got one left for you. You made it. You made it to the end.
All right.
Almost there. So my last question for you, and you've name dropped a couple, but they weren't actually yours, so I'm going to ask it. Who is the greatest teacher you've ever had?
Okay, well, I actually had two. One was actually, believe it or not, a CTE teacher my senior year when I came to the school I ended up being principal of. He taught me graphic arts. And if you know anything about me, you know that I do a lot of marketing, Green Button, all of that stuff. I'm at 51 years old when I took this job. When I was a principal at any of the schools I was at, they will tell you that what I brought to the school was a culture, and the culture was driven by really nothing more than marketing and graphic design or graphic arts and those kinds of things. And so the teacher I had was Ken Steffens. He was actually a longtime teacher in our community here and just did a phenomenal job. He did that. He facilitated our learning, allowed us to, I learned things from silk screening to what it meant not to silk screen the Adidas logo and try to sell it to other kids. I understood now what trademarks were because of him. But he taught me all of that, but he also taught me life skills. And I was actually with him probably a couple days before he passed away. He had cancer, and I was visiting with him in the hospital. This was just a few years ago. That's how much of an impact he had on me that he still, and I was with his family, and I was telling his family what a difference he had made in my life and how much I had learned from him. The other one was a man named Robert Blake. I was a military brat until I came to this community. I came here my senior year. Prior to that, I went to seven other schools all over Massachusetts, Michigan, Illinois, and then in England. I went to military schools in England. But he was my junior English teacher, and he took this shy, quiet, scared little kid and got him onto the debate team and got him into speech competitions and got him into going up in front of people and talking, something he had never done. And so through the beauty of Facebook, I've also been able to reconnect with him. And so we've had conversations for the last 3 or 4 years. He's long since retired and probably, I would think, I guess in his 70s now, if not more. But he brought English. He was the reason I went to school originally to be an English teacher, because he had had that profound of an effect. I mean, it's kind of funny that he got me started in college and I ended up as a CTE teacher with Mr. Steffens kind of line. So the two most impactful teachers for me actually influenced my life enough that I made a career out of it because of both of them. And so can't really say, give much more of a testament to them than the fact that I became a teacher because of them in the long run. I went a different route to get there, but that's where I ended up getting to.
I love the idea that a great teacher will stay with you forever, in the sense of, you know, you've maintained those relationships all these years later. And I think that's just such a powerful testament to them. But also they both have that component of personalization, right? It isn't the stand up and lecture. It's the recognizing you, recognizing your talents and pushing you to do more than you thought you could do. You know, I think that's where the connection comes from, is they're recognizing you as a person and taught you as a person, not you in mass by standing in front of a class, right?
Then that's exactly right. And that's why I believe in the power of the facilitation instead of upfront, because that allows you to connect to each kid, to see where they are, to know what they need, and to really really make that personal connection. Because, you know, let's be honest, the relationship no matter what people tell you, is important. And, you know, I prided myself when I was a principal, and pride is always a difficult word, but I prided myself in the fact that I loved going to watch kids perform in stuff they loved. I didn't care if it was drama, football, chess, French club, whatever. I loved seeing kids doing what they did. And I learned early on that just going and being present and telling them afterwards, hey, good job. I know you lost, but you played a good game, or that was a great shot you took, or, you know, what a great move on chess or whatever. Man, I'm telling you, they were yours forever, you know, and you realized how little it took to engage them and how hungry they are for that. So a classroom teacher who understands that and has them every day and connects to them individually, that's how you get 72,000 likes on a silly Facebook post, because of the connection that a teacher like Jeff Redding has made to hundreds of students. That had nothing to do with me. I'm just the schmuck who videotaped it and posted it, right? And luckily there were some students that we had in common. And then from there, it just went ballistic around the world, right? But that's because he connects to his students. He knows their name. One of the quotes I loved about him was, he helped me find myself. I mean, how powerful is that? You think that young lady will ever forget him in her life? No. So it's, I just think the connection and the relationship and an individuality is a powerful thing. It makes all the difference in the world. It made those two that I mentioned, you know, I'm 57 years old. I was, 40? That'd be 40 years ago when I had Mr. Steffens, and 41 years ago when I had Mr. Blake. And you know what? I can still see them and feel them, and they still affect my life every day. It's crazy. Crazy.
That's awesome. It's a great place to close this thing out. We're coming up on an hour anyway, so that's nailed it. That's pretty great. You know, Mike, I really, really appreciate your time so very much. Thank you so much for joining me on the show. How can my audience get a hold of you if they would like to, or can my audience get a hold of you if they would like to?
Oh yeah. I mean, you can go through, the email. That's not a problem. It's probably the easiest way.
All right.
You know, or they can visit me downtown. I work down at, in our big building downtown. So, but anyway, yeah, you know.
All right.
And, you know, I'd be happy to answer any questions they have about career and technical education, or anything else they may have when it comes to education. That's, you know, that's kind of the fun of being on my end of, 30 plus years. You know, I can speak freely.
I like it.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Armbruster, I really, really appreciate it. Thank you so much for joining me.
All right. I appreciate it too. Thanks for the opportunity. You have a great, rest of the day.
Thank you, Mike, for taking the time to be on the show. You did not disappoint. To connect with Dr. Armbruster, you can email him at the link in the show notes. If you have comments or questions about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter or Instagram. I'm at Brad Schreffler. I love to hear from you there. That's also a great place to connect if you'd like to be a guest on the show. Or you can check out the feedback page on my website that gives additional feedback options as well, which you can find at bradschreffler.com/feedback. Until next week, remember that great teachers don't lecture, their students learn. Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a proud member of the VoiceEd Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. VoiceEd Radio, your voice is right here.